We'll move on to the third and final presentation given by Harold Martin from the Center for Manx Studies on Texts and More, Results of Graveyard Service in Britain and Ireland.
Right, thank you very much. So, yes, this isn't going to be a Manx presentation. Certainly not going to be in Manx, so you can be saved from that worry. I don't speak Manx. Only 63 people do, so. it's an officially endangered language. But there is one primary school that teaches through the medium of Manx, so always not possible. What I'm going to do today is indicate some of the ways in which looking at graveyards is historically and culturally extremely interesting, but I'll also link it through to how it relates to various issues of conservation, community, wider interpretation, and indeed pastoral issues to do with modern memorials and how they can be contextualised within a historic graveyard, something which is more common in some situations than others, but can lead to very fraught issues of alienation and misunderstanding. I don't know why that's appeared there, but anyway, let's have a little bit to move on. What I'm going to do is go through a whole series of examples of the sorts of things that you can find out from memorials. Now, I'm largely not looking at individual memorials per se and all that can be extracted from any one memorial, but it is amazing how much can be extracted from individual memorials. I'm more interested in looking at a sort of wider overview today to show the sort of way in which an accumulation of knowledge can be extremely informative. And in Britain, we were a bit slow getting going on this compared with our North American colleagues. And they did quite a lot of work because they've got very splendid graveyards in New England. If any of you have ever been around any of the New England graveyards, you'll know that they are truly astounding. And I would recommend anybody to you, don't go there in the fall and see all those red leaves. You can see those anywhere. Go to New England to see the monuments, and don't go in the winter because they will be buried in snow. So just go and have a look at these. They are truly stunning. And some very famous archaeologists did a study over a range of sites in New England. This is time, starting in the 1680s. These are each decades, going up to the 1840s. This one, 1700s to 1820s. And the width of the bar represents the proportion of gravestones at a particular time that have a particular motif. And they start off with death's heads, winged death's heads on their stones. These are then metamorphosed in quite an interesting set of transitional forms where you have skulls with moustaches and eyes and eyebrows, and gradually they become cherubs, and then you get a significant discontinuity where the cherubs are abandoned and they have urns and willows as their motif on the top of the stone. Now, these aren't the only motifs, there are other motifs at any one time in use, but these are enormously dominant. I have tried producing equivalent graphs for British graveyards, and they have been appalling, disappointingly disastrous. And so I wondered whether they'd cooked their data. And when I went over there, it looked like the data was all right. And then I got another independent set of data that was collected by different people for a different purpose, and I put it into my computer program, and I produced my computer output, and it was exactly like theirs. So it's definitely how their data is. And our data isn't like that. Our data is much messier. More options, more variations, which at one level, when you're trying to do a very simple explanation of change through time, this is fantastic, though no one agrees why. It's fantastic, but there's a trend. What the trend means, no two historians or archaeologists or art historians agree, but there's a clear trend. We have a much messier picture, but actually that tells us much more about British society, class divisions, different religious denominations, other factors that are actually influencing the choices of monument design, whereas here you're dealing with a very strong Puritan community which is very exclusive, and very limited in terms of who's having the stones by class and education. So there's sort of pressures there which actually create a uniformity rather than necessarily reflecting what we get from ours. But it inspired us, or inspired me anyway, to think, what can we get from the British memorials? And we're looking here more than what many people think Grove stones as, but they are mines for names and dates and relationships to help people do their family history. Now, they're certainly good for that, but they are physical objects, commissioned, created, and placed by people in memory of other people. So they're as much about living people as they are about dead people. In fact, they're rather more about living people than dead people. Some people do put them up while they're alive, saying what they're about themselves, so that when they're dead, they know what's been said. But generally speaking, they're put up by the relatives of the deceased, and may or may not emphasise what those deceased people would have liked. Now, one of the things that's quite interesting about the physical form of a monument, for those of you who are historians who think of text, is that the text itself is informative. There are lettering styles, you've got the actual form of the letters, you've got ligatures, you've got different styles which are partly by date and partly by carver. There's been quite a lot of work done in, again, more in North America than here, which has allowed individual carvers to be identified by their lettering styles. You have how far the lettering is laid out, how well the line breaks are organised, which again changes through time, but also through space. And we have different distributions here, some of the Irish material, the Republic, but there's a lot of variation in lettering. And although this is most dramatic perhaps in some of the earlier stones, these 18th century stones, in the 19th century you get a vast array of lettering styles influenced by typography. The fonts that we were hearing about that are not the baptismal fonts actually become a very dominant element of design on memorials, and what is done in italics, what is done in capitals and so on, is often making as much of a statement about what is important and being differentiated within the inscription and the thing you look at as the actual words themselves. So the physicality of the monument is extremely important. I'm sorry, this is rather small, but this again is my version through time. Starting here at the top, 1810 down to 1970, much later, these are Welsh stones, but we're looking here at one of the changes which we see more easily, even though we don't have so many death's heads and we don't have urns and willows. We have urns generally in Britain. Some of you may come from parts of the United Kingdom where you do have urns and willows, for example, North Wales, but most areas we're urns rather than urns and willows. But here we have it emphasised through the phrasing at the beginning. So some memorials are very much emphasising the memory, and some memorials are very much emphasising the placement of the body. Here lies the body of. So, and you can see here in Brimberian Independent Church, we have quite a lot of Bedd, which is the Welsh, and Lies Body ones, and then the memories. And you can see how the Lies Body stops. The Baptists haven't got very many bodies, remembering. And the Anglicans, as you might expect with Anglicans, are sort of dithering somewhere in between. Okay, so. But generally speaking, if we went back earlier, which we don't have the stones for in this particular part of the world, we'd have a lot more Lies Bodies. Okay, so you go from Lies Bodies to memory. And then the memory actually becomes more and more treacly memory. It becomes loving memory, and then very loving memory in Welsh. So you get these, in late Victorian monuments, you begin to get much more sentimental inscriptions than you get earlier on. So it starts off being very much, here is where the body is. And that actually goes back to one of the reasons why memorials start in the very late 17th and early 18th century, which is to mark the plot which your family is staking a claim to. Because if you think about it, before memorials, after a generation or so, the location of the bodies is forgotten, and you can rebury very easily in those areas. And as we know, those of us who are involved with interring in historic graveyards, you know you go through lots of other people on your way to putting in the new one. So that is the pattern of recycling. But as soon as you start using monuments, you start marking graves, keep out, this is privatised space, and that's why you need your graveyard extensions. You didn't need graveyard extensions in the Middle Ages because you recycled the ground. But putting in monuments, markers, marks out these spaces to prevent them from being utilised by other than that immediate family. And so that is quite an interesting process, which itself has all sorts of psychological and social implications. But people are doing that. So the more wealthy people who can afford stones can protect their bodies from invasion, and the poor have to make do with being reburied over rather longer, until we move into more recent times where people sort of think that it must be full up, so we'll open a new area. And it does raise issues. For example, when you do church extensions, a lot of people cannot imagine there's anybody under the ground because there's no marker, whereas in fact, of course, the ground will be quite likely quite full of people near a medieval church, and they just don't understand that there's no marker. But in fact, for most of the time when the burial grounds in use, there are no markers. But when they come in, they are making clear statements in all sorts of ways. And some of these are conscious, people are deliberately making those decisions, and some of them are just part of the package of how things are at that time and in that place. So some of it's sort of subconscious cultural conformity, and some of it is conscious decision-making and manipulation of how they want to be perceived, that and how they want that dead person to be perceived. In Wales, for example, one of the ways in which people were perceived was by reference to the Bible, biblical phrases. So we have an awful lot of epitaphs which are phrases from the Bible, often, actually, even if the stone is in Welsh, in North Pembrokeshire, where I've done a lot of my work, the biblical quotations are in Welsh, which actually, interestingly, shows how the language of formal officialdom is English, but their colloquial language and their language of faith at another level is actually in Welsh. And it's quite interesting to see that some stones are completely in Welsh, some completely in English, but the majority in the 19th century are this mix. And it's quite interesting seeing the variety of books that are being used, and also within those, how many of the verses are different. So although there's an awful lot of revelation, it's the same four verses that tend to be selected, whereas for some of the others, it's actually quite diverse. There's something wrong there. So Psalms, there's 30 Psalms, and there are nearly 20 different Psalms referred to. And these often seem to be linked to the funeral sermon address, which was often linked to a biblical verse. And one or two of those actually do make you wonder what the sermon was about. One or two of them are about adulterers or how people never forgive. And so you do wonder quite what the sermon was, and you do also wonder what the relationship between this verse and this quotation and this memorial and the deceased person was. But anyway, we can't really go there, but it does show an interesting set of associations that are being played out in this arena. And of course, what is interesting about these monuments is that they are public monuments. They're privately chosen, but they are publicly visible. And they're publicly visible for, if not all time, for a long period of time. So again, they're different from the funeral oration, which can obviously have an impact, but then is over and may be talked about. But the stone is there and is a socially active, physical item in a frequently visited space thereafter. And so unlike the church, which is largely constructed by groups or by elite individuals' patronage, these monuments are being constructed by a wider range of society. So this is a visibility of a bigger group of people and their choices, their cultural choices, than we normally see in most of the material that we see, in most of the documentation we see. So this is quite an exciting opportunity of getting into some elements of popular culture, which is important. So here we have some examples of language. We've got a stone completely in Welsh, interestingly here, maintained by being repainted. That's a slate stone, repainted white, and then rather badly in black. Messed up going over the lettering here. Obviously don't know quite how you need to do it, but anyway. And then you get the styles of the lettering and the way in which those lettering is chosen, whether it is what language. You get quite a lot with Greek on or Latin as well. And also you see the amount of mistakes here, so less missing. It's rather a fine monument, but they misspelled the name of the place where the person lived. And also you get interesting variations in spelling, which are not necessarily mistakes. They're obviously just the variation of the non-standard spelling. There's also the materiality of the monuments themselves. They have a physical presence which is distinctive. And we see early on, nearly all the monuments are made from local stone, and that's not true in some places like Norfolk, where most of the material can still be coming in, but it's coming in from very specific places, usually. And so the amount of variation in the materials is quite low early on in the graveyard's history. And then during the later 18th century, you usually start to see some marble appearing. And then you get the explosion of different types of material going through the sort of Scottish granites and so on, and then moving on until now we have lots of South African and Chinese and other materials being used in graveyards. So you can actually see the transport infrastructure, the globalisation, and indeed the mass production. So all these here, these are Scottish granite, this is Scottish granite, this is Scottish granite. These are pre-carved in terms of their shape and the outline decoration at the quarry or at workshops near the quarry. Then they are transported by sea and rail, and then they are in the they're then lettered up locally. So there's an element of local production, but there's an element of mass production. And so you move from local styles of design, like the top two, to national and indeed internationally occurring design. So you can see how the graveyard memorial forms part of the same pattern of changes in people's material consumption as we see with ceramics or so many other things, that this change in the what you can choose, how you choose it, alters. So you look at pattern books to choose these with your monumental mason. Now, one of the things which is always challenging is, because we've talked about how a lot of people are not getting monuments, is how representative are these monuments and of whom? Now, a recent study by Sarah Tarlow and a team from Leicester have shown lower percentages than I'm showing here. So clearly there are some interesting variations across the country in this. But in these two large parishes in Pembrokeshire, we can see this is the number, the bottom line is the number of memorials by decade. Then this is the number of people commemorated, because obviously a lot of memorials have more than one person. And then this is the number of burials in each of those decades. And you can actually see there is quite a high proportion from about the 1850s, sometimes a bit early, it rises up, because it's very, very low before that. And this particular area, some areas it starts a bit earlier, but it still is only this sort of angle. And then from this time on, you can see you've got depopulation here, but you can see that it's about two-thirds of the people who are dying are being commemorated. But Sarah Tarlow, in some of her Leicestershire samples, both urban and rural, has a much lower representation rate, which, considering that quite a lot of the local material she's dealing with there is slate and it's very resilient, it's not like they've eroded away. So either they're being cleared away and not surviving for many generations, or something else is happening which is affecting the proportion of people who are having stones commemorated. But if we look at these people up in the census before they died, we find there are an awful lot of agricultural labourers, blacksmiths, mariners, not just master mariners, who are getting stones. So we're looking at a across-the-class range here as an evidence of material culture and of people making decisions, making their cultural values and their, to a certain extent, their theological and social values clear through these monuments, which is an unusual way. Normally we can't access these people. So this is really quite exciting if this type of work were done more places. It'd be very interesting for this to be done in more places, to actually see what this proportion is, and also to see what the missing one part is. Is it just children? Is it what sort of people are in that represented and non-represented section? We've done a bit of that in some short ones, but not to the point where I can report the results, but we're trying to look at whether it's to do with age and so on. Now, one of the things that I find particularly exciting about graveyards is their layout, their spatial layout. We've been hearing about how churches have all sorts of different elements within them and people can go around and they don't understand them. Well, people often wander around graveyards, but they understand those even less than they understand churches themselves. And I think the churchyard is an often underexploited resource in terms of the sort of heritage tourism, in terms of links with the community, in terms of links with schools and so on. And I think it's a fantastic resource, actually, and one that can be turned to very good effect in terms of linking with communities. And I would say that some work has been done in cemeteries, urban cemeteries, on links with youth and schools, and seen in, and brought people in and seen in those cases often the nature conservation value of the areas and the cultural historical values of the monuments, and the decline in vandalism has been most notable. So that really does show how this communication of values to a lot of the interested or rather not interested groups in the area can have a very beneficial effect. So I think that's something that's, again, worth thinking about. But what we have, of course, is a dynamic landscape. People think, just like they think of churches as static and timeless. People think of graveyards as static and timeless. Well, even most of the people under the ground aren't very static and timeless, actually. But even if you see them as fairly static and timeless, the point is that the landscape as a whole and who's being added to it is a continual process. And so actually, if you map out, sorry, again, these are probably a bit small, but, you know, in 1720s, ruined church in Ireland, relatively few memorials. By the 1760s, rather more memorials. The few black dots are the ones actually in the 1760s. You can see how they've been added to rows. Little clusters are appearing, and so on. And then in the 1790s, we now have far more memorials. They've spread further out. The stars are ledgers, and you can see there in a sort of ring, a lot of them around the edge. There's differentiation by class and group as to where people are being located. And so the whole land, you can see how people are making choices of where their burials are going to take place and what sort of monument they're going to have with reference to what is already there. They are choosing their monument in its context. To be the same as other people, to be different from other people, to be bigger than other people, to be the same size as other people. They are making a statement by those choices. Now, sometimes they are constrained by resources, but they are also constrained by what various social norms and ideas about how, and their idea of indicating their place in the community through these monuments. These monuments are not just marking the bodies, they are highly significant in terms of characterising that family and that memory. Now, one of the things which the Americans have always been very big on, carvers and the carvers doing the stones. And that's helped by them because they have a lot of probating inventories associated with wills which say who carved the stone for a particular dead person. So if you find the stone of that dead person, you know who carved it, even though they haven't necessarily signed it. Sadly, in Britain, we don't have very much of that information, which is a real pity if you're interested in understanding the carvers. In the 19th century, more stones are carved. with their names or initials. But one of the interesting things to think about in terms of the creation of these monuments is the relationship between the commissioner, client, family, and the carver, and the producer, in terms of the set of blanks that you might choose from in the 19th century or 20th century. And that relationship is one that's actually still quite problematic. We're still working on quite what that is. Because clearly, of course, I'm talking about these people making all these choices, but how far is it they just drag along in the stonemason, you know, a bit like some undertakers, basically tell you what you want, and you say in your emotional state, oh, that's all right then. Now, stones tend to be commissioned after, significantly after burial, different stage of the grieving process. I think people are more in command when they are commissioning a memorial than they are earlier. Now it's often all part of a package, so they're not, but in the past it tends to be significantly after the burial, in order that it goes up and doesn't immediately subside. So they're in a different position in the grieving process, which means I think they are more in charge. But there is still an interesting range of what the carver is prepared to produce versus what the commissioner wants. And that may be a factor in some of the choices. We need to bear that in mind. Now, just to show you what it's like to do choosing, this is an early 20th century example. I mean, you might have thought the stepped marble cross was a stepped marble cross, but oh, no. The stepped marble crosses with knobs on here. So you can have every sort of different variety of cross. You can have it with ivy on, or doves, or IHSs, or, you know, whatever you want. You can have it. You can have it a bit more Celtic. We make it into a real crucifixion. And these, of course, are not even British. These are all Carrara marble. So you don't even have a British stone. So this is your Italian stuff for you. And the Italians, unfortunately, because you're only in the ground what, 25 years, most graveyards in Italy, most graveyards in Spain, you're only in 25 years, Portugal, and then you're out. So unfortunately, the number of historic gravestones in Italy are quite low. We have some that go back to the early part of the 20th century with the photographs on, so on, and a few 19th century ones, often someone seemed locally significant, so they've retained the gravestone. But sadly, the proportion of monuments that go back through time in most Mediterranean countries is quite low. And so we don't realise how lucky we are in the British Isles to have this heritage. We have a heritage which much of Europe does not have, because people were only buried temporarily, whereas we naively think we're buried permanently. But here's some of these are the ones that we saw in the Welsh example. These are the types that you could order. So you order this, there's a number, it can be sent off in a telegram, and the stone can be delivered. So that's what you're looking at. So actually there's more choices in one sense more recently. And in fact, if you look at the arrangements of and variety and aesthetic value of the stones, you'll see that there is a big dip in the sort of 1930s to 1960s when they become very dreary. And now, they're fantastic, aren't they? I mean, bad taste can run riot just like it did in the 19th century. Now you can have the most naff and awful, sickly stones back again. What computerised machinery and chemical etching and colouring can do now is truly astonishing. And at one level, for some of us, this is an aesthetic nightmare. In another way, of course, it is freeing these popular cultural choices up again. How these should be related within historic graveyards and where they should be relocated and what should be allowed for all sorts of reasons in consecrated ground versus public cemeteries and all the rest of it is a whole set of issues. But in terms of a reflection of cultural phenomena, these monuments are historically much more enlightening than most monuments from the 1950s and 1960s, which really are remarkably dull and contain relatively little information to differentiate one person from another. So we've gone through a dip in the part of the 20th century, but in the 18th, 19th century, and now, late 20th, 21st century, we're back in really enlightening times. And so we have all sorts of ways we have memory. So we have this fantastic stone from the 1730s, remembering an Ulster planter family, dealing with those nasty Catholics rebelling in the defending Londonderry. And then we have the equivalent remembrance of military activity or professions on the stones we have now. So we have, and we have a gap in between when some of this isn't really being revealed. One of the things which is interesting is looking at the scale of the units that make up the burial. In part, a lot of the Mediterranean countries, there are a lot of families have a mausolea, and they are treated quite interestingly in similar ways to many prehistoric burials, in the way in which families are kept together, as they are indeed in these Irish plots here. You see, this is an Irish family plot with a whole series of monuments, with many generations, the way in which these are genealogically powerful and statements of local families and local lineages are really quite significant. Here we have one where an earlier stone is not standing up but has been laid flat. And these are also seen in Britain. This is a Welsh example where those cheerful coffin slabs mark where the different burials have taken place. But a lot of burials here are relatively small numbers in any one plot. So that again is an interesting idea of what is acceptable in terms of how many people go together in the ground. That is saying something about social relationships, about treatment and attitudes to the body, which are really, can be really quite profound. And up to one point people are able to express that, but the point they are just making those decisions without really articulating what they're thinking, but it reflects some deep-seated feelings about how they see themselves. And that's really quite important information. And a lot of graveyards, because of their management, have curbs removed, and actually that removes a lot of the evidence of the statement of plots that are actually really important. Just as we lost a lot of railings in the Second World War, for no good reason. If you go to parts of Ireland where they didn't do that, you can see quite how a forest of railings does completely alter the landscape of the graveyard. Removing the railings, the curbs completely, further makes it more of a communal area as opposed to a series of privatised blocks. Just as the landscape became enclosed in the 19th century, so the graveyard became enclosed. You marked off your little bits. Privatisation of space. And you get a lot of interesting issues of competition. Here we have a gentry family with loads and loads of names on each stone. Looks like very economical. The local farmers have big monuments. They're competing with each other. These people, that from within the safety of their own defined enclosed plot, don't play the competition game at all. So all the farmers and tax officials and local administrators are building all sorts of competitive monuments in the same graveyard, but the gentry, they're not into that. They don't need to compete and show how important they are. And anyway, everyone has to sit in church and look at another set of memorials to exactly the same people on the walls as they're not really listening to the sermon. So they have their own strategies for making sure you don't forget who they are, whereas the other people are using their monuments to do so. And many of you are probably interested in one place, but actually if you contextualise that in a region, you can see variations in time and space, a bit like we were seeing with the Americans, though with a rather more messy pattern. And I've done work on nonconformists, Anglicans, rural and small town group in North Pembrokeshire, as one example, then another group of parish of burial grounds in Ireland and in Yorkshire. And it's extremely illuminating to look at the ways in which there are different strategies that are cross-cutting across those different contexts, urban, rural, denominational, and so on, and ones where there are different degrees of control by different social classes. So I really recommend this as a way of looking at graveyards, and it's a communal activity. It can be schools, it can be people in the parish, it can be historical, family history people, all sorts of people can actually be brought together to work on these, and the information that's recovered is of quite a different quality to the information that you get from the documentation. So that creates its own opportunities, but also its own tensions. And also, of course, it is under threat of erosion, even if not of vandalism. And so it is actually quite a timely thing to do. Some of the graveyards I recorded in the early 80s, you know, go back to now, and it's interesting the degradation of some monuments that has occurred in that time. This is not something that can be put off forever without serious loss. So I'll stop there and see if people have any questions or comments.
It's a fascinating paper, Aaron. It's open to your points.
Well, I just wonder what your views were on sheep. Sheep used to grave churchyards, because yes. I'm thinking of one churchyard in particular where sheep are used to keep their grass down. And it's my perception that in the last few years, the upright tombstones have been leaning over. And of course, in the course of time, they fall flat on the ground and they disappear into the ground. Do you think the sheep are contributing?
No, the sheep won't be doing that. It's no. People below the ground that are doing that. They're decomposing.
Oh, right, so that makes the ground unstable, so that's an inevitable process.
If you never buried anyone in the graveyard, none of the monuments would move. It's the people decomposing that causes the problem.
But so, the parish councils ought to have an accurate policy.
Most accidents that take place in graveyards happen with stones from the last 20 years. Now, there are two reasons for that. One is that they're badly constructed, because they're not actually... There are a number of elements that are very lightly cemented together, and as soon as that cement or mortar decays, then the monument collapses. The other is, of course, that they are visited by aged relatives visiting their spouses. That's where they're going. And so when they put the flowers on the grave, they get up leaning on the stone, and the stone gives way, and they fall over and break their arms. So it's partly because those are the areas most visited by people most likely to have an accident, but it's also because they are most badly constructed. Most big monuments that you see that are leaning have a third of them below ground. They're not going to fall over. But most of the monuments of modern type, which are often on a pedestal, have nothing that beds them onto that pedestal very securely. And so it's very easy for them to be rocked. I remember the last time I was out in an English graveyard with some students, I bent down to see how a student was getting on with the stone, and I realised the stone they were recording, I could rock back and forth like that on its pediment. It was completely loose. It just needed the great wind would have... it would have looked like the vandals had been in blowing them over, but in fact, it was just merely the mortar joining it to the base had gone. The old ones are really easy to put upright, because all you do is dig a triangle behind, push the stone back in and fill in the front. I mean, it's not really a very difficult thing. You don't have to take them right out. You just have to take out...
Actually, you mentioned that. Reminds me that recently we were in Crippen Cemetery and we read a notice which said that there was going to be a risk assessment of the memorials.
Yes. There's a terrible machine called a topolometer, which is a machine. I was doing some external examining at Newcastle University, and I used the opportunity to nip along to the cemetery. Wherever I go, I nip along to the cemetery. I'm that sort of person. And I thought the vandals had been in, because all the stones were lying flat, and the oil was spraying over all these stones. And then I realised it was someone had been around with a topolometer. And the topolometer is a thing that you affix to the stone, and it vibrates. And if there's any evidence that the stone is moving, they push the stone out, saying it's dangerous. And then someone's meant to come along eventually and put them back up securely. But of course, once they move from being a collapse hazard to being a trip hazard, basically.
Would it happen in a churchyard?
It has happened in churchyards.
Is there a legal requirement for churchyards to do that?
No. And in fact, the topolometer is likely to cause more damage and make stones unstable. But stones that are leaning are very easy to put upright. But more concern should be all those late 19th, 20th century stones that are on a base or on a some sort of pedestal, and it's how they are joined to that that is undoubtedly the most likely thing that's going to go wrong. But I have some... I have a really awful picture which I think I'm going to show in my workshop this afternoon. But this one up here, this type up here, they're very common in West Wales. It's a very nice regional type. I imagine, though my wife won't spend that amount of money on me, but I would love to have one of these when I go. This is what I want, but this is a good example. If I want one, I'm going to have to buy it myself first, because I'm sure she won't. But she knows I love these. But they're a whole series of pieces of slate put together. But the things that join them together can be wood, can be copper alloy, or can be iron. And if they've corroded and rusted, then they split the stone there, or they can have rotted. And you can see this panel's come off the front here. And some local authorities are basically dismantling these in large numbers because they're afraid people will be... I mean, so I've been going around doing recording and taking photographs, and I've been accosted, thinking I'm a health and safety person, planning the demise of their graveyard. So they're usually all right. If I've avoided being lynched, then they're usually very pleased, and I think they're absolutely wonderful, and they should be preserved at all costs. But they are quite a difficult conservation matter, these multiple ones. But generally speaking, and that's why a lot of chest tombs, you know, the box tombs, where often the top slab is a very hard material for the lettering.
The other's
brick, or it can be very softer material, which was great for doing carving of fluting and columns and things, but has eroded badly. There are a lot of those get lowered. Because there have been a number of cases of children crawling in underneath, making little dents underneath, and then the stone coming down and killing them. So those need to be considered as a risk. They're not very difficult to conserve, actually, to prop up those slabs. It's not really very difficult. I don't approve of them being collapsed. But they often do need some form. So that's the only old form, I would argue, that is really... dangerous.
You need to take the iron off them as well.
Yes. And there is often an interesting conflict between cultural preservation and some health and safety and nature conservation. And the nature conservation people have done such a good job on, you know, living churchyard sort of projects that when you talk about conservation of graveyards, people immediately think you mean butterflies and flowers and not the physical monuments. And the cultural heritage people are way behind the game on protecting these landscapes, cultural landscapes. And we are in danger of losing out, as we have on several of the cemeteries in London, for example, where it's the nature conservation people who are happy for monuments to be pulled apart by trees, because the tree is more important than the monument. And I think there are battles there which those of us interested in the historic environment need to take up, because there's not really much of a quid pro quo. I remember going to one conference about churchyards where I was doing a talk. So the whole group of conservation people, there was a bats person and a moths person and a grasses person and a butterflies person, and I was the only cultural heritage person there, and I was on last, and they were there sort of sharpening their bush knives and all the rest of it. And I gave my presentation, and afterwards a woman said, "But we've got a graveyard with badgers in it, and they're undermining all the stones, and some people want the stones to be kept upright, and the poor badgers, where will they live?" And I said, "I don't care anything about the badgers, frankly. There are badgers everywhere. These are people's monuments." And the monuments were of no importance. It was the fact that a whole graveyard, and all these bones, they said, people are moaning because all these human remains keep being brought up by the badgers, but where are they going to live? And all the whole thing was subsiding and collapsing, and no one was able to go in and look, all because of these blessed badgers. I found the whole thing mysterious. So we are way behind, if you have any idea of the cultural value.
You mentioned some people arrange their stones in advance of buying.
Yes.
Is that a regional thing or cultural?
There are some reasons. There are some. There's one graveyard in North Yorkshire, I can't remember the name, where the vicar wouldn't let people buy a plot ahead unless they put a stone up. So there are rows of empty stones. In fact, this graveyard in County Louth, which was filling up, buy now to avoid disappointment, all the plots in the graveyard were bought up by people, and they put up stones that say, in loving memory of blank.
Or what's his face?
Yes. I mean, sometimes you do get the name, you know, with no date. And, so people can go and look at themselves, sometimes, and I've seen this in North America as well, you get the name and you get the first date, dash, and then they've left the second date, blank.
That spectacular example in Yorkshire, is it otherwise a sporadic?
There's a very amusing Simpsons cartoon which is all about Homer's dad making plans for his demise and Homer being refusing to be railroaded into buying what's called a pre-need package. And so there is this scheme where you buy a package which includes your plot and your stone. North American. But now, of course, a very large number of the funeral companies in Britain are actually owned. They're part of big North American chains. So this is a sort of style. But it's been going on one lens for a long time. When I first went to York and I moved into my house in York in the early 80s, the first piece of paper I got through the door was an advert from the Carp saying if I bought an undertaking package from them, I'd get a free settee. So in some ways, this packaging has been,
In New Zealand, when you die, you get asked when you go along, do you want to buy the space for one, two, three, or four people?
Yes.
How many people do you want the space?
Yes.
So in a way, you pre-buy.
Well, that's actually what's happening with these plots, because, you see, it's partly how deep you go, because how many you anticipate going in. So if you want to get six in, you've got to go, and it's too wide, you've got to go three down for the first one.
So you tend to get three for the price of one.
Yeah.
One and a half.
That's right, yes, and that's why there's a lot of double plots.
And there is also, there is an issue, actually, of very poor grave digging, certainly in our I'm afraid... For our local churchyard, it drives me nutty. Some of the people who come along with their little diggers, to dig the graves, they have no idea what they're doing at all. Whereas others actually know precisely, and it's been handed on from father to son. So it's very variable.
Yes, the quality of the.
And certainly one coffin that was being put into a dug. Space in our churchyard, the space wasn't long enough for the coffin, which caused, as you can imagine,
the
relatives, they were extremely upset at the funeral.
Yeah,
it just wouldn't fit in.
Yeah.
So there are issues today because people haven't got the skills; they don't know what they're doing.
Harold, if I understood correctly, so this is a sort of documentary system, or to. Rediscover and telling maybe a lot more about living than the dead,
and
also reflecting a lot of social boundaries and perhaps a lot of inequality.
It's
telling a lot about class rules and divisions and conflicts.
These days, most burial grounds in Britain, anyway, are not much visited. People visit for a relatively short period of time following interments. There's been quite a lot of studies of that to see the patterns of grave visiting and maintenance. And it's one of the problems that we have with graves that are where people want to put things up which require maintenance is the fact they're not going to get that for very long, even though people want all their little teddy bears and their spinning wheels and all the rest of it they want on the graves because they're not going to be maintained. So, but in the 19th century, 18th century, these were major social foci, and so the significance of them is quite different. Now they seem peripheral, socially peripheral, whereas there they were much more central.
Utilitarian.
Yeah, and I think that's quite a difficult. That's important for us to remember. So in other words, these decisions are much more important then than they seem to be now. Now I do wonder whether now we're moving back to where people are having more choices and they may feel more engagement and with the monuments. Well, that might alter. Now, you know, we went through this period when it was very authoritarian and there were very few choices about what they could do, and people were alienated by the very monument they were allowed to create. But that was less important.
Well, yes, but dioceses are, you know, there is quite a lot, certainly in our diocese, being told that they can do this and they can't.
Yes,
do
yes, yes. Very, yes, we had a very interesting case where the Chancellor was.
You know,
decreeing whether you could put Nan on the stone or not, and all this
because
sort of
people
stuff.
Have
but in fact, if you go around and look, for all that the diocesan, you know, sit on the diocese, you actually go round and the popular culture seeps in. And
it
sometimes it's unfortunate, and sometimes it's you can see it's pastorally, it's very, and culturally, it's very appropriate. But of course, if you go into other sorts of burial grounds, then there are different sorts of rules applying. And of course, that will be a pressure because you've got it in these other contexts where you're allowed to put these things, and then not in some of these. So there are, but I mean, the idea that, I mean, our diocesan regulations in the York diocese still say that people should have their whole names, you know, not their nicknames or what they're known as by everybody in the place. Well, you know, if you want to go and visit Fred's grave, do you really want it to say Frederick William? Or do you want it to say Fred? You know, you can see how from a sort of what's the purpose of the stone, and so for some people it is a formal memorial, official document, but of course that's not how the family is seen. So
imagine it becomes most difficult for in connection with memorials for very young children, where you see the parents attempting to put emblems on the tombstone which would have some meaning for the child. And very often those are quite innovative and personal.
Yes, they are. But they're remarkably, they seem innovative and personal, but in fact they're incredibly repetitious when you see a lot of them.
Right.
Incredibly repetitious.
And very often I would imagine they're going to borrow emblems from contemporary life, like the Snoopy, for
they
instance.
They do, or teddies. And teddies. Teddies are very popular. But you also get shrine-type constructions on the children's graves. And a lot of toys put on them, and so on. And these, you know, have maintenance issues over time. So there are complex pastoral issues there, which are partly dealt with by having these rules, which sort of protect everybody. But they create their own tensions, and we can see in the past quite interestingly what happens. You get quite a lot of monuments put up to children in the 19th century with quite evocative verses and so on. And you wonder how they were decorated or anything in the past. We just don't know. But some of these things appear new, but actually they're repeated patterns of, you know, human behaviour in relation to loss or guilt or whatever, you know, whatever the particular emotions are.
Yeah. Time is running. We should close our session here, I would say, but not without thanking all of you speakers and audience for your contributions and inputs. Thank you very much.
Yeah.